From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I will not allow the mistakes of recent decades past to define the course of our future.
That was U.S. President Donald Trump on Tuesday evening at a joint session of the U.S. Congress.
For too long, we've watched our middle class shrink as we've exported our jobs and wealth to foreign countries. We've financed and built one global project after another, but ignored the fates of our children in the inner cities of Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit, and so many other places throughout our land. We've defended the borders of other nations while leaving our own borders wide open for anyone to cross and for drugs to pour in at a now unprecedented rate. And we've spent trillions and trillions of dollars overseas while our infrastructure at home has so badly crumbled. Then in 2016, the earth shifted beneath our feet.
And that shift was evident on November 8th when Trump unexpectedly beat Hillary Clinton and became president of the United States.
The rebellion started as a quiet protest spoken by families of all colors and creeds, families who just wanted a fair shot for their children and a fair hearing for their concerns. But then the quiet voices became a loud chorus as thousands of citizens now spoke out together from cities small and large all across our country. Finally, the chorus became an earthquake, and the people turned out by the tens of millions, and they were all united by one very simple but crucial demand: that America must put its own citizens first, because only then can we truly make America great again.
The president then outlined some of the problems facing the nation when he took office last month.
Tonight, as I outline the next steps we must take as a country, we must honestly acknowledge the circumstances we inherited. 94 million Americans are out of the labor force. Over 43 million people are now living in poverty. And over 43 million Americans are on food stamps. More than one in five people in their prime working years are not working. We have the worst financial recovery in 65 years. In the last 8 years, the past administration has put on more new debt than nearly all of the other presidents combined. We've lost more than one-fourth of our manufacturing jobs since NAFTA was approved, and we've lost 60,000 factories since China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. Our trade deficit in goods with the world last year was nearly $800 billion. And overseas, we have inherited a series of tragic foreign policy disasters.
Trump tried to reach out to Democrats in Congress and members of his own party to solve those problems.
Solving these and so many other pressing problems will require us to work past the differences of party. It will require us to tap into the American spirit that has overcome every challenge throughout our long and storied history. But to accomplish our goals at home and abroad, we must restart the engine of the American economy, making it easier for companies to do business in the United States and much, much harder for companies to leave our country.
For more on all that, we spoke with Brian Becker, a co-founder of the Answer Coalition, who currently hosts a program on Radio Sputnik entitled Loud and Clear. We spoke with him via Skype from Washington, D.C., Wednesday. Brian, thank you. I know you're very busy, and it's a pleasure to have you, as always.
Thanks for inviting me.
So President Trump goes before a joint session of Congress for the first time. Nobody shot him. Nobody spit on him. There were a couple of hand gestures or whatever, but I don't think there were any middle fingers involved. And he laid out what he saw first as the set of problems that exist right now and a little bit of the history of it in retail politics terms here. And then as sort of an outline of some of his proposed solutions for that. And I know you were covering it for Sputnik yesterday while it was live, so maybe we could go through some of that stuff.
Well, I think there's both what Trump said and also the media reaction to Trump, the mainstream media. The mainstream media is very much embracing Trump's speech last night in the main. The people who have been in the streets organizing protests and resistance against Trump's very racist and reactionary policy towards immigrant communities and Muslims and towards women, those people are angry that the mainstream media, which up until I guess last night was also participating in ferocious attacks against Trump. They are normalizing Trump right now, and I think that's a big part of the story. Trump obviously was trying to win over parts of the Democratic Party establishment last night. That won't be that hard because the Senate is a millionaire's club, and the House of Representatives is largely a millionaire's club. It's a group of privileged and pampered politicians. Of course, they have electoral differences because they, the Democrats, want to defeat the Republicans in 2018 and 2020. But outside of their contest for who will be in charge of the state apparatus and the governmental apparatus and all the spoils that bring with it, they have a lot more in common with each other than they do have at odds with each other. So I think normalization
it's a club,
of Trump.
Right? It's a club that they all belong to and you don't, basically.
Right. It's a Congress of the elite. There's no working person in the Congress. There's no poor people in the Congress. There's no immigrants in the Congress. There's no green card holders in the Congress. I mean, even the most supposedly liberal Congress people or senators, they're part of the elite. They are part of the 1%. It's their authority. And they take turns trashing each other and bashing each other. And at the end of the day, they're really friends. It is part of a club. And working folks, the working class, the poor, in other words, the majority of the population, they're just not represented there. Trump, you have to look at also what the Trump cabinet looks like. It's been very reassuring to the centers of institutional power in the military-industrial complex. You have Pence, of course, who's a hard right winger on terms of domestic policy, but a mainstream, a hawk, neocon when it comes to foreign policy. He's playing a major role in foreign policy. James Mattis, very popular in the Pentagon, very central to the Pentagon, not deviating from the Pentagon consensus. We have Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, a super hawk against Iran, also a hawk against Russia. Within the Trump cabinet, there are also, of course, the very conservative business people, the oligarchs. I would say a cabinet of generals and oligarchs, so you can't really expect a lot of change there. The only thing the Democratic Party establishment has been really going after Trump for is the effort on the part of Trump to say that he wanted to improve relations with Russia, which in this day and age means that Trump is the Manchurian candidate of Putin. Of course, when George W. Bush said he looked into Putin's eyes and could see his soul and could see that he was a good man and Bush wanted to reset relations with Russia, that was okay. When Obama and Clinton tried to do the same in 2008 and 2009 when they had that big funny red reset button that they gave to Lavrov, which was mistranslated into overload instead of a reset, which confused Lavrov. They all wanted to, quote, have better relations with Russia. That was considered sort of normal part of American imperialist diplomacy. But nowadays, the hostility towards Russia and the consensus of hostility towards Russia is so great that Trump himself, who's not progressive, is not a radical in any way, was considered to be a deviant by the establishment because he wanted better relations. But Trump himself seems to be changing his tune, I would say, on that and under this current circumstances. The increase that he announced right before the speech which he reiterated the need for of a $54 billion increase in defense spending, a 10% increase. That comes from the discretionary part of the budget. That means it's going to come out of the budget somewhere else. It'll come from education or from housing or from environmental protections. And, of course, Trump wants to get rid of environmental and labor protections and the bureaucracies that are existing to protect those things. In other words, it's a shift of resources from things that actually serve society or serve working class or middle class or poor people to the military-industrial complex, sort of like what happened with Ronald Reagan. And if you remember, Don, when Reagan came in, the ruling class politicians, some of them were afraid that Reagan was too extreme, too far right-wing. But as soon as he kind of pulled it off, they all started rallying around him. Right. And I think we're seeing some of that now with Trump a month into his administration. I would say that the increase of military spending, one, will be understood in China and Russia as directed against them. It won't be really considered to be mainly against ISIS or Daesh. It'll be understood by them to be the Pentagon taking a bigger part of the national budget for a full-scale modernization campaign, which will be perceived then and will be a threat by those major military powers. The other thing that Trump did that I thought was very noteworthy and perhaps a little bit different from other politicians, I would say more than a little bit different last night, was when he announced at the end, he said, "I'm not the president of the world. I'm the president of the United States." Mm. Now, that's an important political statement coming from the CEO of the American state, that is the president of the United States. Since the end of World War II, since 1945, the United States has been in charge of and the leader of an international world order that the United States policymakers constructed between 1943 and 1945, towards the end of World War II when they knew it was coming to an end.
That's what they called the free world. The president was the leader of the free world. That's what they called the free world. That was the PR.
The free world. So you had and it's really important to analyze what happened there. And I think to look at Trump and to see that there is perhaps a sea change, but in an unexpected way with Trump. The U.S. policymakers who had been, of course, American imperialism had been a lesser imperialism than British imperialism. At the start of World War II, U.S. imperialism saved the world capitalist order. It rehabilitated Germany and Japan, the enemies that resuscitated capitalist Western Europe through the Marshall Plan. And the purpose of the New World Order as constructed by the U.S., with the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, and Bretton Woods declaring the dollar as the world currency, was designed not only to give the United States hegemony, not only to give the United States dominance, not only to give the United States a position of super profits, but it was designed to end the scourge of inter-imperialist war, which had led to the catastrophe of World War I starting in 1914, and the catastrophe of World War II, that started in 1939, 1940. Right. Both of those wars led to revolutions, revolution in Russia, then revolution in China, revolution in Asia, the undoing of the world capitalist order, which laid smoldering in ruins in 1945. That's what the United States was trying to prevent, a return to World War III. And under the leadership of U.S. imperialism, it turned the other major imperial powers into junior partners, made them into an anti-communist united front against the USSR and the other socialist revolutions and other national liberation movements. But by so doing, it also gave them access to markets. It allowed Japan to regrow. It allowed Germany to regrow. In other words, the United States reconfigured a world order designed to end the scourge, not of war, but of inter-imperialist war. Right. And so for Trump now to say, as he's been hinting at, that he's no longer the president of the world, he's also signaling a change in ideological tone. And I think it can be attributed to Steve Bannon's influence, away from the United States being the leader, as you said, of the free world, the imperialist world, and returning to sort of a pre-World War II political orientation, which I believe will profoundly alter the relationships both between the United States and Europe, and between the United States, Europe, and Japan, and China and Russia as well. In other words, I believe we're going to enter an era of unrestrained or unmanaged inter-imperialist or inter-country rivalries, which, of course, are exactly the things that led to World War One and World War Two. And I don't think the U.S. ruling class establishment saw this coming, but Trump accidentally, I think he's an accident of history in a way. He gained the electoral advantage because of the complete arrogance and hubris of the Democratic Party establishment, their refusal to do anything but function as the elites, and Clinton's extreme arrogance allowed her to lose Wisconsin and lose Michigan and lose Pennsylvania. So Trump came in, and this group of right-wing ideologues, including Bannon and Fisher, and Trump was certainly heeding their call. They've reoriented the American position to this America First position, no longer, quote, trying to lead the free world. And it has its corollary in Europe with what's going on in France, what's going on in Germany, certainly what happened with Brexit in the UK. So I think we are seeing perhaps the incremental but certain unraveling of the post-World War II world order.
Let me ask you, I agree with you on that, although in terms of framing it, you know, this happens at the same time as, you know, China's economy begins to eclipse that of the United States. It becomes somewhat more assertive in terms of its foreign policy, at least in terms of constructing economic relations around the world in Latin America and the development of the, you know, Eurasian area, all of these different things, the bridge to the String of Pearls to Africa. And if there's going to be a multipolar world, because there's a push for that from a number of places, including Latin America, for example. How exactly would the hegemonic policies of the United States be adjusted to that reality? In other words, does it necessarily, and I know when you have competing capitalist systems, so far in history, and it was predicted, you end up with the kinds of conflicts we saw in the world wars, but is that necessarily the outcome? And if it is, what other method is there to accommodate multipolarity? Because you can't suppress it without, you know, successful hegemony. How do you accommodate the conditions that are, you know, globally springing into being with U.S. policy?
Well, I think we really have entered uncharted territory in a way. It doesn't mean it's not somewhat similar to what happened before World War One, or somewhat similar to what happened before World War Two. I mean, none of the historical periods repeat exactly. And of course, there's the famous phrase from Marx that history repeats itself first as a tragedy and then as a farce. Right. That seems to have relevance in many instances. But I do believe we're entering an uncharted path, because Russia and China are not part of the imperialist club. They are pursuing capitalist property relations in the main, but in the case of China, all land is still owned by the state. The state allows capitalist property relations to develop, but it's still under the supervision of the Communist Party and still has a power that other states, like capitalist states, don't have over their capitalist classes. I mean, it's more the state functions as the servant of the capitalist class in the West. In China, this capitalist class exists at the pleasure, so to speak, of the Chinese Communist Party.
And the party is connected to the working class in a way there, and to the peasantry, to the extent that still exists, in a way that does not exist in the United States and Western Europe.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you don't see, I mean, from time to time, you see large numbers of capitalists in China being rounded up and imprisoned, and some of them executed for bribery or corruption or so. I mean, you would never see that in the United States. The death penalty is exclusively a preserve for poor people. If a capitalist got executed here, I mean, it would be like a tsunami. But of course, that will never happen.
Right.
So anyway, China's doesn't quite fit the mold of the capitalist imperialist system. But it is in rivalry with the United States. It's not in rivalry to divide up colonies or semi-colonies, but certainly it's trying to garner access to resources, not really for the purpose of Chinese corporations becoming super profitable. It's really a developmental strategy.
Right.
That's why China can offer better deals to Latin America or to the Middle East, even to Iraq for its oil, than the U.S., because it's not trying to maximize profit. It's doing it for access to resources.
And it tries to develop its partners under the win-win theory, which is essentially, if we end up making you wealthier, you can buy more of our stuff. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but that's kind of the dynamic.
Yeah, it's not a classic colonial or even neo-colonial relationship, which doesn't mean there can't be great power chauvinism or other problems associated with that. But yeah. I don't mean to be utopian about it. But it's just different. It's a different mechanism. So here we have. I think what's likely is if under Trump the United States forges an ever closer relationship with Britain at the expense of the EU, I mean, I think that means the EU under German leadership would start to gravitate in the direction of Russia. Trump has not thought this through. I don't think he's thinking things through. You know, I don't think he's a big thinker. That's putting it mildly. I think, though, that the U.S., the wise heads, to the extent that they exist in the U.S. imperialist establishment, do know that it would be natural and historically, a reaffirming if Germany starts to have a looser relationship with the United States, it will gravitate in the direction of Russia.
Yeah.
That would completely undo the current world order. I mean, Russia is hoping for that. Unfortunately, I think the Russian government is pinning its hopes on the unraveling of the EU more with the existing anti-EU parties, which are right-wing parties like Le Pen, the National Front in France, UKIP in England, which is, of course, now in decline. But nonetheless, the centrifugal forces within the EU, I think, are real, and I don't think they're going to stop. I think things are going to shift dramatically in the next years. And as they do, if the United States under Trump forges an ever closer relationship with the Tory government in Britain at the expense of the EU, Germany, maybe not Merkel, but other German politicians will find a way to move in the direction of Russia. That would be a major game changer.
You know, and like, there's a lot of things in play there, too. And first of all, in terms of the right wing parties that are the more nationalist perspective, talk about Le Pen, for example, and others. In Greece, though, you have Golden Dawn, not flourishing in the same way as Le Pen, because you also have Syriza. In other words, there's a viable within the conditions that they all face, a viable alternative. And I'm wondering if something like that could develop in Germany. And looking at Germany as, you know, the center of Europe, with the UK moving towards the United States, if that's what happens, certainly without the constraints of the United States, Germany's going to at least gravitate towards Russia, because that would actually be normal from where they are at the moment.
They've exactly. Been,
yeah.
Exactly. And now, yeah, it definitely would be normal.
So from a multipolarity perspective.
I think Golden Dawn in Greece, because it's an explicitly fascist organization, is a minority, where the National Front has fascist elements, but also has, you know, tried to sort of have a far right, but not completely fascist position. So it has a little bit more standing. We'll see what happens in the elections, which are coming up. But certainly if Le Pen were to win, which I don't think she will at the end of the day, although I said I would stop making predictions after the November 2016 U.S. elections. But if Le Pen were to win, that would change. I mean, this would be like that would be an earthquake politically inside of Europe, I would say. Trump, you know, the thing that's really interesting about Trump's speech, just to go back to that in our last couple minutes.
Yeah.
He dragged out these three families whose loved ones have been killed by what he calls illegal immigrants. You know, that's completely gratuitous. I mean, Don, you and I know this is a violent society. 30,000 people died from gun violence alone last year.
Right.
So many murders. I mean, it's the country grew up on guns and gun violence. And by Trump doing that last night, as if illegal immigrants, so-called, are the ones perpetrating violence, it's designed only to create hatred. I mean, it really does create fear and hatred. And most of the fear and hatred comes from the people who don't have contacts with immigrants. Because if you have contacts with immigrant families, you know these are working-class folks. They're trying to get their kids to go to school. They're trying to live. Right now, they're
same
living in the shadows
is.
Because they're so scared.
Yep, I know.
And this demonization. I talked to a woman the other day. I want to just share this quick story. She's a worker. I know her. Her neighbor is a husband, a wife, five kids. The husband drinks, but usually drinks at home. He went out to the store around 6 o'clock. He had like two or three beers. He got stopped. She told him, don't go out. Don't go out. He went to the store. He got stopped. He had alcohol in his breath. That was 10 days ago. They haven't seen him. They assume he's in a prison somewhere and he's going to be deported. They've been here for 30 years. All the five kids are citizens. The wife feels that she may never see him again. Her husband, who's a worker who just goes to work every day. But because of what's going on, where local law enforcement has been empowered to just send anybody, and it's these expedited deportations now. I mean, it's a little bit like the experience Jews were having in 1934 and 35 in Germany, where people were afraid to go outside. I mean, that's, to me, the most important thing right now, is that for progressive people to realize you can't normalize this kind of racism. You can't let this kind of racism and demonization of a very big part of the U.S. working class go on unchecked. We have to find a way to stand together. And to the extent that the Democratic Party elites, who I said before, they pretend to be all against Trump. At the end of the day, they'll cooperate with him. If he says, we'll have an infrastructure program, which will really be the privatizing of infrastructure, they'll say, that'll be good for jobs. Well, Hitler had a jobs program, too. I mean, if that's the criteria, I mean, it means you have no principles. And I think standing with the immigrants really is the number one top priority right now for progressive people.
Yeah, and that's a position that both you and I have held up to and before January 20th, by the way. Last president.
Obama set up a deportation machine, and Trump is using it to its fullest. He's put it into high gear.
Yeah, I mean, for example, the list is something that he inherited. And at this, and by the way, just a very quick parallel story. You know, there's another side to that too. This demonization of Russia. I was speaking today with a woman who's a Russian immigrant, as is her husband, and they have a child that was born here, and he's getting a lot of grief at school from kids who call him a spy and all kinds of other things because he has a Russian name and he also speaks English and Russian.
Exactly. The Democratic Party leadership, the contemptible imperialist Democratic Party leadership, won't stand with Mexican immigrants and Honduran immigrants or Salvadoran immigrants, really. They'll just pretend to. They won't stand with the people who have been banned from the seven Muslim majority countries. And they're all together happy to demonize Russia and Russians. And it's contemptible. And it just shows if progressives follow the Democratic Party, it's like digging our own grave. We must find a way, if we're going to resist Trump's reactionary policies, to resist the Democratic Party fully, forcefully, without compromise.
Brian, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.